Hello, everyone. Thanks for joining us today. My name is Hani Adhami. I'm a consultant in Microsoft Services. And with me today is Gareth James, who's also a consultant in Microsoft Services. I have to apologize on behalf of Gareth. He had a marathon run yesterday, had three sessions in a row. So that's, 3 hours and 45 minutes of talking. So he has lost his voice, but we're going to do our best to sort of project his voice by kind of upping the gain on the mic. I'd like to first of all thank you all for joining us today. I know at this time of the week it starts to sort of, your kind of enthusiasm starts to wane a little bit. People start to wander down to the beach and think about other things to do. So thanks very much for coming out today. We're going to be talking about cluster shared volumes in Server 2012. And can I just see a quick show of hands, who in our audience actually knows about CSVs and what they're about? Okay, it's a reasonable number. It's probably not as many as I was expecting, but that's fine. I guess for you guys who do have experience with CSVs in 2008 R2 today, this session is really about what's changed. So what are the major investment areas in in the 2012 operating system with regarding to CSV? And for everyone else, don't worry too much. This is a deep dive session. So we will get into sort of the nuts and bolts of CSV. But I'm going to start quite high level. So it's going to be a quick overview. I'm going to describe, you know, what the value proposition of using CSV in your data centers today. So why would you use CSVs? Then we're going to look at what's changed. So what have we improved in 2012 regarding performance, backup, and so forth? And of course, we're going to look at the new architecture in detail. It is a deep dive session, so we'll look at how it looks and behaves under the hood. So what are cluster shared volumes? Why do we use cluster shared volumes in our data center? And again, for you guys who've had experience in CSVs, I apologize, I'm kind of going back a few years. I just want to level set and make sure that everybody's, you know, on the same page, so to speak, and we can all follow the presentation and enjoy it. So if you think about Windows failover clusters prior to CSVs, what do we have? We have a bunch of nodes that are configured to work together to provide high availability in some sort of a service or an application. Now, the restriction has always been that NTFS is not a clustered file system. Okay, and what does that mean? It means that only one node in the cluster has exclusive access, read-write access to a given LAN, right? And it means any highly available application, such as a virtual machine, so if you have multiple virtual machines accessing that LAN, it means they have to be hosted on the same node, right? And that binding between the applications and the storage mean that they form a failover group. They fail over together. So it's not really a nice solution. We don't have the mobility to be able to move virtual machines or failover virtual machines around individually. So what do CSVs do? How do they solve these problems? First of all, they allow all nodes in the cluster to access a volume simultaneously, an NTFS volume simultaneously. So we're abstracting the application from the storage underneath. So you can host virtual machines anywhere in the cluster, and they don't know about who owns the disk resource, right? So they just see cluster storage volume. They think it's all local, and we can orchestrate metadata updates through the node that owns the LAN. Excuse me,
You're sounding almost as bad as I am.
I think I'm catching whatever you had going.
Shouldn't spend so much time in the hotel room last night.
Oops, I think this has been recorded. by doing that, we don't need to change drive ownership when we're failing over, right? So it means we get faster failover performance as well, so less downtime, essentially. So what are the management complexities we're solving with CSVs with particular regard to Hyper-V clusters? So we're going to be referring to Hyper-V clusters a lot, right? The intention with cluster shared volumes going forward is the product team wants to be able to support any application going forward, right? But really, Microsoft obviously getting very serious about virtualization and private clouds. The primary use case was virtualization, Hyper-V clusters. So prior to CSVs, we had This requirement to have to, a one-to-one mapping between virtual machines and the storage underneath to get that required flexibility, right? So if you have a cluster with 100 virtual machines, what does that mean, 100 LUNs, right? That's really difficult to manage. And of course, as you scale out and you scale up, you start running out of drive letters and you've got to reference storage by volume GUID. You go, you know, whack, whack, question mark, whack, volume GUID. It's not a really nice way to manage your cluster. We had capacity management issues, right? So if you had 100 LUNs, you've got some LUNs, you know, almost at capacity, other LUNs that are poorly utilized, so you're not getting the most efficient use out of your storage array. And of course, there's all the management overhead of zoning and masking and you know, so forth, multipathing. There's a lot of admin overhead associated with managing all those LUNs. So these are the kind of problems we're trying to solve with cluster shared volumes. So for those of you guys who have experience with CSVs and R2 today, when you enable CSV, you'd see this pop-up message saying, don't use it for anything else than Hyper-V, right? We won't support you, okay? There's a good reason for that, not so much a technical one, but CSV essentially went from being a concept on a whiteboard in Redmond to a feature you can use today in under 12 months, right? That's quite an aggressive time frame. When you think about the complexity involved in making a file system behave like a clustered file system, that's really quite incredible, to be honest. And the way they were able to do that was to constrain the supportable workloads. So we said, we're only going to focus on Hyper-V, we're going to optimize for the Hyper-V I/O profile, we're going to make it work for the necessary file system APIs, and so that's how they were able to achieve that. And the way we introduced CSV in R2 was we put this mini filter driver way up in the file system stack. So we listened to any I/O coming into the CSV namespace. If it was a metadata update, we orchestrated that over to the coordinator node. So the node that actually owns the disk resource is the coordinator node. Any other read-write I/O, we sent it straight down to the class driver, the storage driver for block-level I/O. Right? So we were bypassing everything in the file system stack. And that obviously causes some interoperability issues, as we'll see shortly. So when we revisited CSV in Server 2012, what did we want to improve? So we want to expand it for more workloads, right? So we now support a scale-out file server role. And in fact, the CSV feature is key to enabling a scale-out file server, okay? We've improved backup. So you know backup was quite painful in R2. In fact, it was crap, to be honest. If you wanted to do a VSS snapshot of a CSV volume, you had to call a special set of CSV APIs, and you know, not a lot of backup vendors were able to do that successfully. You'd have to move the LUN to the node that was requesting the backup. The cluster was in redirect mode for the entire backup, so you know, that could have been hours. So really, it wasn't an acceptable solution. So we've improved that also. We've improved performance, so we're going direct block-level I/O for more scenarios, and when we are redirecting, we're doing that in a more efficient manner as well. And we'll be looking at that as well. We support storage spaces. Who knows about storage spaces? Okay, a few people. There's enough there that haven't put their hand up. So I'll just quickly explain. Storage spaces are a new feature in Server 2012 that essentially allow you to pull together low-cost commodity hardware, put a layer of virtualization on top, and carve out virtual disks and present that to your workloads. Right? So we now support CSV volumes running on storage spaces as well. And we have multi-subnet support, which we didn't have previously. So we've changed the architecture. In fact, CSV behaves and looks and feels like CSV in R2, but underneath it's a complete rewrite, right? It's completely different under the hood. We're no longer implementing a filter driver at the top of the file system stack. We're actually loading a new CSV proxy or pseudo file system on each node in the cluster, right? So what that means now is antivirus applications, backup applications, have somewhere to interject, so either at the file system level or volume level in the proxy file system stack. So we've improved interoperability with third-party vendor software. We can now take application-consistent snapshots across the entire cluster, so we can actually request a snapshot of a CSV volume and ensure an application consistent state across the entire cluster, which we couldn't do before. We could only ensure application consistency on the node that requested the backup. This is a really big one, actually. We've removed external authentication dependencies, and this is more a failover clustering enhancement rather than CSV. So what that's really referring to is that redirection I talked about earlier for orchestrating metadata updates, that's done using SMB. And so when you establish a session with the coordinator node using SMB, that session has to be authenticated, right? So you have to go out to Active Directory. You're consuming another a third party, if you like. If you had networking issues or your DC was down or what have you, you'd fail to redirect. You'd fail to establish that session, essentially. And if you're on a non-coordinator node and you lose access to your storage, and you know, and if you fail to redirect, your VMs are dead in the water, right? So we've resolved that issue by we're using a common local cluster identity account that's synchronizing all the nodes. So we've removed that dependency on authentication against Active Directory. And in fact, this solves a really interesting scenario that I think Gareth experienced this not too long ago. If you have a cluster and you've virtualized all your domain controllers, let's say you have a situation where you lose all your nodes in the cluster, right? You bring them back online, you know, you make sure networking storage is all back online. So what's the cluster service trying to do when it starts up? It's trying to authenticate against AD, right? What are your highly available DCs trying to do? They're waiting for the cluster service to start, right? So you're in this situation where everyone's waiting on each other and you sort of get nowhere. So we've also improved that by having the local cluster identity, the common cluster identity.
I'll just interject there for a second and, again, forgive my voice. I sound like that kid from The Simpsons. Oh, it comes out of my salary. If I had a girlfriend, she'd kill me.
It's his bedroom voice.
That wasn't so much of a big deal for production implementations because obviously in a larger environment, you've got distributed DCs. You could usually rely on a DC external to the cluster being available. But for proof concepts or test labs or small environments where you would just, you know, maybe had one blade enclosure with, you know, half populated blade enclosure or something, and that was what you were allocated, and it had to be self-sufficient and everything had to be on there, it actually really became quite painful in terms of if Hanny said if it all went down, when it came back up, you can actually force the cluster to start without the authentication, but the one thing you couldn't get back online was the CSVs. So that situation's now been improved.
So that's a big win. Oops, going the wrong way. Already done that. Okay, so a little bit more about what we're delivering with the new CSV architecture. We now support memory map files. We support BitLocker encryption of CSV volumes. Previously, we only supported encryption of traditional physical disk resources in your cluster. And we also integrate with all the new 2012 file system features like offloaded data transfer, spot fixing, so the new check disk mechanisms. In fact, if you're not familiar with how check disk works in Server 2012, there's been some really great enhancements around that. Now, a lot of you guys who are server admins out there, you'd know that you kind of dread running check disk in the past. You know, the time it takes to run check disk against a volume, and you know, depending on how big that volume is and how many files you have on the volume, it could take hours or, you know, maybe even days. And of course, you have to take that offline, so the volume has to be offline to run that check disk operation. So in 2012, we've actually split it into two phases. Well, actually, it's about five, but two main phases. So we're doing an online scan. So when we're actually looking for file system corruptions, we can do that while the volume's online, and it can still accept I/O. So when we determine that there's file system corruptions, we alert the administrator, and then obviously you would schedule a change window to take that volume offline and run the repair. However, the repair typically only takes minutes or seconds, right? So that's a remarkable improvement in the check disk operation. But with CSV volumes, we're actually taking that to the next level because we have this spot fixing feature, which basically allows us to do the whole operation online, right? So how are we doing that? As I said earlier, we have this proxy CSV file system, and we're essentially able to pend I/O up to the application. We can dismount the NTFS volume underneath, and we can do the spot fixing. We run that for a few seconds, remount it, and then flush the pending I/O again. right? So it's essentially seamless, transparent operation from an applications perspective. So a little bit more about the architecture. We're sort of looking under the hood now. How are we doing I/O synchronization? So how are we orchestrating the metadata updates to make sure we avoid file system corruption? So I said before, we have a coordinator node. So that's, you know, the node with the purple line there, which is the owner of the disk resource. And that is responsible for ensuring that, you know, all metadata operations are safe, essentially. Now, obviously, we're doing the orchestration, the I/O synchronization on the server side. Traditionally, clustered file systems, other clustered file systems on the market, have done it on the storage side, right? So they have some way of orchestrating volume locks, you know, ensuring that only one node is doing metadata updates at once, and you know, avoiding situations where we can have corruption. The reason we're doing it server side is we found that storage side solutions tend to have scalability issues, right? So as you start to scale out, you have many nodes in the cluster, lots of VMs, you can have lock contention, and there's actually a lot of guidance out there published by the vendors to say, you know, this is how you should carve out your volumes, and this is how many VMs you can place on those volumes. So from a CSV perspective, we don't have those restrictions because we're doing the orchestration on the server side. And I should point out, obviously you could have multiple CSV volumes presented to a cluster. Each volume can have a different coordinator node. So you can have different nodes in the cluster owning the disk resource to get sort of parallelization of your metadata updates. So that's sort of how you can improve or distribute that that load. And so what are metadata updates? I talk about metadata updates. From a virtual machine perspective, it's things like, you know, powering on and off the virtual machine. So, you know, your opening handle, and then the rest of it is sort of read, write I/O, which goes direct down to your storage driver. You know, live migration, live storage migration, things like that. Really, the key takeaways here is metadata updates are quite small and infrequent operations. So it's not something you need to be overly concerned about. And because we can distribute the ownership of disk resources across the nodes in the cluster, again, we're improving the efficiency of that operation. So this is quite a busy slide. This is really the crux of it, of how it looks under the hood. And I guess the main point to take away from this here is, again, we're loading a proxy file system stack on each node in the cluster, which we weren't doing before. So now your minifilter drivers can attach, you know, at the file system level, at the volume level, depending on what type of scanning or backup or whatever they're doing. So we've improved interoperability in that manner. The other thing you'll notice is we have a CSV file system filter on top of the NTFS file system stack. And what that's doing is it's masking NTFS from the application. So the application sees CSVFS, right? It thinks, it knows it's running on something. Well, it's not something different. Underneath, it's still NTFS, right? But we want it to know that it's a CSVS, a CSV volume, to, I guess, ensure compatibility so they know how they have to behave. The other key takeaway from this slide is you'll notice node 3 has lost connectivity to storage, right? And this is a new path going to disk. So this is block level I/O redirection. Obviously, that's a logical line. We're still doing SMB redirect over to the coordinator node. But the interesting thing here, the change from R2 is we're going from the bottom of the CSV proxy file system stack to the bottom on the coordinator node. So we're not traversing the file system twice. Okay, we're getting increased performance out of that. This is basically just to show you that setup of CSV volumes has been improved as well. It's quite simple. It's all integrated into failover cluster manager. There's no separate node like we had in R2. You basically select the disk you want and enable it for CSV. I don't need to say any more, actually, because Gareth is going to run a demo for us now and show us how that works. And I just have to say, we couldn't get the screen to actually duplicate onto our laptop and on the monitor, so you're going to see a lot of kind of neck turning to see what's going on. So we've set up a two-node cluster. Obviously, both nodes are running server 2012. We've presented some disk to that cluster. You can see there, Gareth is just navigating through and showing you how it looks. It comes up in a moment. We've got some virtual machines on there. We've got some storage. And so what we're going to show you now is basically we've presented some raw disk to the cluster, and in the usual manner, we'd mount it up on a node, initialize the disk, partition it, create a volume. It's got to be NTFS, of course. I'll get out of your way. Okay, so we should see some raw disk presented there. Scroll down. Okay, disk 4, so it's a 5 gigabyte disk. A bit further down, yep. So we're just going to do the usual. This is nothing new. We're just going to online that disk. We're going to partition it, create a volume, so forth. I should point out here that the volume does have to be NTFS. Underneath, it's an NTFS volume. We don't support FAT or FAT32 or REFS for that matter, the new resilient file system. So presumably that's coming, given the direction of the company. So at the moment, it's NTFS only. So, okay, we've initialized that disk. We're going to go into Cluster Manager. We're going to add it as a cluster disk resource, as we'd normally do. There's only one disk available. So okay that. And then Gareth is now going to do the overly complex task of adding this to CSV. It's going to right click, add to cluster shared volume. And we're done. So it's as simple as that. This is a very simple demonstration, but I guess that's the point. We wanted to highlight how easy it was. And now if we navigate down to Explorer, you see we're actually presenting C cluster storage, so that's the CSV namespace which is presented consistently across all nodes in the cluster, right? So on any node in the cluster, you can navigate to C cluster storage and you see those CSV volumes. Gareth is just showing now that you can rename a volume, right? If you've got a volume that's hosting virtual machines for a line of business application, let's say, you can rename that line of business application. And if we just jump on the other node and navigate to that same location, you should see exactly the same thing. So again, we can access the volume from all nodes in the cluster in a consistent manner. And that's basically it. So I already touched on this. Basically, we're presenting a consistent namespace across the cluster, and you can see those volumes. Each CSV volume you create will have a mount point in there. We've changed to standard mount points from custom repass points in R2. The reason for that is we found that management applications such as operations manager or instrumenting sort of performance counters and things like that had issues traversing those repass points. So, you know, it couldn't translate the GUID to a friendly name and that sort of thing. So by using standard mount points, we've enabled better interoperability with these types of applications. Again, we're presenting a CSV FS to the application. So when you see this, don't worry. You haven't repartitioned or, you know, you haven't reformatted your volume. It's still NTFS under the covers. But we're just presenting a CSV FS just to ensure compatibility with applications. Okay, I'm going to hand over to Gareth now. He's going to talk a little bit about the improvements around resiliency and performance in CSV.
thanks very much, Annie. One point that I wanted to touch on just before I get on to that was a point Hanny mentioned, but I really think it bears further emphasis, which is about how many VMs that you can fit on a LUN. Because we don't have those types, the same types of limitations, really when people ask, and it's a question I get a lot, is when we're going down and we're doing Hyper-V cluster designs, it's like, okay, how many, you know, how do we do our LUNs, how many VMs can we get on a LUN? And as much as it would be easy for me in consulting to say, oh, well, here's a white paper and you know, here's how many things you can get on this, the answer's not that simple. The answer is simply it depends, and it depends on your storage and what type of I/O throughput your storage can give you. You won't find any limitations from the Windows cluster or the CSV side of the house. So basically, you can stack as many VMs on a LAN until your back-end storage just runs out of IOPS. We'll just drive it to failure. So the question then becomes, how do you set up those LANs? How many spindles are they distributed against? And it depends on the storage vendor as to what they're going to tell you. Some might come back and say, well, we need to know the exact workloads that you're going to be running so we can do our IOPS calculations and you know, we can sort of work it out that way. And other vendors might say, oh, we don't care. We've got this fantastic tiered storage system and we move stuff around and we just give you the IOPS sort of where you need it, when you need it. So that's not so much of a concern. And it also has to be said that that's been the case really since the first release of CSV in 2008 R2. But previously, we could have had a LAN as big as you liked and chuck as many VMs on there as you liked, you know, driving your storage to its limits. But then the concern was always, well, how big is that volume in my check disk and that kind of thing. But as Hani touched on, we've addressed those issues. So I'm now going to be covering off how CSV enables high availability, and I'm also be touching on the performance aspects of things. So CSV provides us good I/O fault tolerance. Now, the reason why it does that, and again, Hani touched on it where he was talking about the offline, how it takes it offline temporarily to do its live check, and then it does that for a few seconds, runs its fixes, and then comes back online, and that's a zero outage or zero failure operation. How we actually achieve that is through the use of a virtual file handle. So when the application actually puts a file, a lock on the file handle, normally that would be, you know, a direct handle, and if the underlying storage goes away, then you're in trouble. But what CSVs does is it maps a virtual file handle in, which it can retain open even if then we lose the underlying real file handle. So if something were to happen, we lose the underlying storage, that real mapping is gone, then the virtual file mapping is still held, and we basically buffer the I/O until that real handle under the covers is re-established, and then we open the floodgates again. So it's that virtual, it's the connection of that virtual file handle that allows us to maintain that level of resiliency. So that was really sort of that second lot of dot points was what I just sort of talked through in terms of failure occurs, queues the I/O, reconnects, and then transfers through again. So what that happens is the system is very tolerant to those type of sort of, you know, failures, and it's transparent to the application. I mean, that has limits, obviously. I mean, if the whole storage array goes down, yeah, the virtual file handle is going to hold, it's going to start queuing I/O, and then it's getting to a point where it's just going to go, nah, the storage just fundamentally isn't there anymore. So obviously there are limits to that, but for those type of minor, smaller failures, it's very resilient to that. I mean, if you lose your storage array, you lose your storage array. So let's have a look at the I/O connectivity and fault tolerance. As Hani mentioned before, we have the concept of a coordinator node, and the coordinator node is really what really owns connection to that particular LAN. So when we're talking directed, direct I/O, that's happening direct to disk, regardless of what node it's coming from. But when we're doing metadata updates, that is then sent to the coordinator node, who really owns that LAN and transferred through that way. Again, as Hani mentioned, we also, every LAN within a Hyper-V or a CSV cluster can have a different coordinator node. So you can have multiple owners of multiple LANs throughout the cluster. So let's have a look at a couple of failure scenarios and how the system's going to handle it. So as you can see there, we've got a two-node cluster, both connected to your common storage with that first node acting as the coordinator node. And we've also got that cluster network with the two nodes talking there. For those not familiar with 2000, sort of the way we dealt with clustering post-2008, it's just worth mentioning this. We used to have in 2003 clustering a requirement for a dedicated heartbeat network, and quite over that was just a direct crossover connection between your, you know, between your nodes and the cluster. We don't have a requirement for a dedicated heartbeat network anymore. What we require from a cluster point of view is two dedicated paths that the nodes on the cluster can talk to each other over, that are over separate paths. And as far as the cluster validator is concerned, separate paths means along separate subnets, that it can see separate routes from its perspective. So what we tend to do when we architect a Hyper-V cluster is you tend to have that cluster network. It can be a private network. It doesn't need to route to the outside world, although there's no reason, you know, it can as well. There's not a support recommendation either way. But we tend to have those networks internal, and then we can also tend to use them for other things, such as live migration or CSV redirection. Quite often, these clusters are being set up with within blade enclosures. Obviously, they give you a good density rate for virtualization. So quite often, that internal cluster network can be handled across a chassis internal network. If you're splitting your cluster across chassis, which is highly recommended, because, you know, entire blade enclosures never go down, right? Never happens. If you're splitting those clusters across enclosures, it's really worthwhile looking into what options that enclosure manufacturer gives you for direct chassis interconnects. Some are better than others, but most of them give you pretty good options and in most cases pretty high bandwidth networks for those dedicated enclosure interconnects, and it's a good way to run your private networks that way. So let's say that on the non-coordinator node, you lose your storage. Okay, so I don't know, cleaner comes in and knocks the fiber cables out the back, or, you know, whatever. So if that node's completely lost its storage, what will happen is any VMs running on that node that's lost its storage will continue to run. And they continue to run because, as I said before, all directed I.O. goes straight to disk. All metadata updates go over redirection via the coordinator node. It now simply says, well, I've got no direct path anymore. I'm going to redirect everything. So all I.O. then gets redirected over the network and then via the coordinator node. So not exactly an optimal situation in that you've got all your direct I.O. going over the network, although it's not as bad as it sounds. You'd think that would be the end of the world, but you'd actually be surprised how well and how efficiently that works. Even in 2008 R2, 2012 increases the performance of it tremendously, but even with R2, I had a customer who had a Hyper-V cluster that had a storage failure, and they were actually running some reasonable density VDI environment on it. The cluster was in redirect mode and they hadn't even noticed. There was no discernible performance loss with what they were doing that they hadn't noticed. It was only because the monitoring came up and said, hey, your cluster's in redirect mode. So, yeah, and it'll, as I said, we'll continue to act over the coordinator node. Now, that's one stage. Obviously, if it's in an enterprise context, your monitoring is going to tell you that node is now in a degraded state and everything's going over redirected I.O. And then potentially that will then initiate, tell VMM to say, right, evacuate this node, live migrate all the VMs off it and put them on nodes where they can then go back to direct disk I.O. So what we're talking about is complete loss of storage from a node, zero downtime movement of those VMs off, no reboots, no loss of function whatsoever. Okay, so let's look at another failure scenario. So again, same situation, we've got our coordinator node. Let's say the coordinator node goes down. Not really that big a deal. Simply, there's a brief queuing of I.O. while the volume ownership is changed. So basically, the cluster's going to detect that node has gone down and said, oh, this cluster owned these disk resources. I'll simply flick the disk ownership over to other nodes in the cluster. And that's a very, very quick operation. So the amount of I.O. buffering is quite small. So So it'll simply just transfer that disk ownership to a new node. Obviously, if there were VMs running on that node, they're going to reboot on other nodes as per any sort of HA failure in that circumstance. That's not necessarily anything directly related to the storage. That's just the behavior if that node was hosting VMs. And then you know, that node continues to run unaffected and is now the owner of that LUN. So from a network fault tolerance point of view, as I mentioned before, cluster requirement is to have two dedicated networks, at least two. I mean, you can have more. At least two. One is private and internal, although it doesn't have to be. One, obviously, then is the network that gets your services to the outside world. So let's say that network path fails. It'll simply redirect that traffic over the other path, really, so it's resilient to either of those network paths failing from a CSV redirection perspective. So we are going to flick over to the demo now. As horrendously complicated as my demo that I drove was, Hanny's got a slightly larger challenge ahead of him.
So I'll just explain to the guys.
Excuse me, this is all same on R2.
Yes. Yes, this behavior of the CSV redirection is the same on R2. There's a little bit, for those who don't know CSVs, it's just sort of giving us a level. What is improved in R2, though, is the efficiency of that IO redirection, and you'll get a good sense of that with what we're going to do now.
So this is actually simulating that first scenario that Gareth talked about. So we have essentially, if you see there, Hyper-V1 owns the disk resources. So it is the coordinator for the CSV volume. If I jump up to roles, you'll see that we have a Win8 client virtual machine which is running on Hyper-V2, right? And we're going to simulate storage failure from Hyper-V2 and watch it redirect, okay?
Okay, so I'll just talk you through what's going to happen, what we're going to do now. So Hanny's just going to show us RDP into that client. And you can see we've got a video queued up that's going to run. Now, before we start that, what we're going to do is he's running going to run the video. Yep, so we now see that video is running. He's going to pop back over to the node that is actually running, that the VM is running on Hyper-V2. We're now going to knock the storage out from under it by disconnecting the iSCSI initiator. Inactive, if he quickly pops over to Disk Manager, you'll see that there's no... No, that's all right. All right, don't worry about it. Just flick back to the thing, to the client. Yep. So you can see the video is still running. That VM's still running, that video is still running, even though the node that it's running on has no storage. Okay, so now just to complete that picture, we're going to flick back over to the cluster manager. We're just going to live migrate that over to the other node. Up, up, move. Up, stop.
It's very hard to see.
Yeah, he's craning around. It's an intricate demo. Okay, so we can see that's live migrating. Flick back to the RDP session, still running. Video still running. Now, just to put it in context, right? We work for one of the largest software companies in the world, multi-billion-dollar corporation. Our demo equipment is 3 laptops. One laptop set up as a nice cozy SAN, the other 2 laptops are the Hyper-V hosts. So to just put that in context, we've got one gig connection out of each of those laptops. That's the only network we have. So that's the host network, VM network, cluster redirection network, live migration network. Everything is going over that one gig. So you can see VM's still running, video's still playing. It's been live migrated over to the other host where it now has directed IO straight back to the storage. And back to that. And feel free to clap, because I thought that was cool. Yeah, move it back over. Sorry, just to really show the video still running. Okay. Okay, now we're going to talk about some improved performance, and the comment that we took before about sort of this was the same in R2, we're now going to start to talk about how we've improved performance in CSVs with, I haven't run the experiment, I haven't done that test with 2008 R2 on that equipment, all going through that single gig network. I don't know if I can't say with 100% certainty whether or not that same demonstration would have worked with R2. I'm not sure if that one gig network would have had the bandwidth to handle everything that we were just chucking at it. But certainly the performance improvements in 2012 enable us to run that. It is an important design point when you're talking about your Hyper-V clusters that you are mindful of your CSV redirection network. Because there is that circumstance, that perfect storm, where a node loses its storage, all your IOs going over the network, at the same time, it's going to initiate a node evacuation. Depends how many VMs are running on that node, right? You could have 20, 30, 40 VMs on a node that are now all trying to live migrate off. Be mindful of your bandwidth and how many dedicated networks you have doing what. You don't want all your I/O for 40 VMs all redirecting over the network on that same network link that is now trying to do live migrations across. So the Hyper-V best practices on TechNet tell you how to carve up your networking and what, you know, how much bandwidth you should be dedicating to networks. You know, please, when you're designing your Hyper-V clusters, be very mindful of that networking side. Okay, so with CSVs in 2012, there's a couple of caching mechanisms that we take advantage of. The first one is just general your Windows Cache Manager, which is just your basic Windows caching for file servers and just how it caches requests and those types of things. We're taking advantage of that with CSVs now as well. So that's really buffered read and write, you know, your traditional NTFS file traffic type of stuff. New in 2012 is the CSV block cache, and we're going to be demoing that. That's going to be our last demo for the session. So that's really optimized for read-only, unbuffered I/O. So a situation where that's really beneficial and where you see great gains is in a pooled VDI scenario where you have one sort of parent master disk that's being read from a lot of different sources, so it's getting hammered from a read perspective. The block caches, it gives you tremendous gains for those types of scenarios, and that's what we're going to demonstrate. The way that it works is it reserves a certain amount of memory on the Hyper-V host. So that's an important point to remember. That caching is held, it's not at the storage level, it's at the host level. So on the Hyper-V hosts within your cluster, you dedicate a certain amount of memory to be assigned to that cache. You can assign pretty much any value you like up to 20% of the total system memory. So then it's a matter of, well, how much RAM do I leave for VMs and how much RAM do I associate with the cache. The product team have done a fair bit of testing and they've actually found that 512 meg is actually quite a good amount. That seems to be a good sweet spot for how much memory you assign. Actually, our demo, we've assigned a little bit more. We've assigned a gig to that, and that's a cluster. That amount of memory that you're setting, that is a cluster wide value. But when you actually enable the block cache, and it is actually disabled by default, so if you want to use it, you have to actively go on and turn it on. That's done at a per volume level. So we're actually going to take you to the first part of this demo, and we're actually going to do this demo in two parts. And the reason why we're going to do it in two parts is simply because the last part of it's pretty cool and we just want to be show ponies. So what we have there is we've got five VMs. These are Windows Server 2012 machines that have been set up in a parent differential disk scenario. So we have one master parent read disk and then differentials for each of the VMs. And we're going to basically just do a low-level boot storm. So we're going to simultaneously boot all five of those VMs, and we're going to time how long it takes. The first run that we're going to be doing, we're doing with the cache off. And then we're going to come back a little bit later after some more slides, and we'll run that same test again with the block cache on, and we'll see what the delta is. So I've got my trusty
stopwatch.
Okay, so when we're ready, Hanny's gonna start that. So in 3, 2, 1. Okay, so the last machine that posts, which I mean the last machine that displays that has RAM allocated, there it is, number 6. We're just gonna console into that. That was the last machine to post, so it'll be the last machine to boot. And we'll just again wait for that to get to its control or delete to log on screen, and we're seeing how long that's taking. So while that's booting, again to put it in perspective of the equipment that we're running on here, 3 laptops, one running as the iSCSI SAN and two running as the hosts. We do not have an SSD in that iSCSI SAN. It is a 7500 RPM. 7500 RPM SATA drive. So really about as slow as it gets. We were really scrounging to get the equipment together for this. When we started to put the demo together, it actually became a point of pride of how well these demos were running on such low-grade equipment. We tried to get Hyper-V running on our phones just to, you know, really emphasize the point, but it didn't work. So we're still going just as a...
How are we going for time?
1 minute, 20 1 seconds minute. So far. So just as a point of interest, anyone want to call out, again, 5 Server 2012 boxes all booting off the same parent VM, parent disk, so that disk's getting absolutely smashed with read IO right now. 5 of those booting simultaneously, how long? How long do you think?
Closest number
Don't
gets
be shy.
T-shirt.
Yeah, closest number. Hey? 7 minutes?
5 minutes.
5 minutes?
3.5.
3.5? Whoa, yeah.
Over here. Okay.
half
It'd
hour.
Be in trouble if it was an hour.
Yeah.
Hopefully. For a pretty boring session, I think.
Oh, yeah, hopefully it's not going to take that long. We had a thing that if it actually goes, once we start crossing over the 3-minute mark, Hanny has to start singing. So let's keep, and with the way his voice is going, that's not going to be pleasant for any of us.
I think dancing might be a better option actually today. Yeah.
So we're still going. So was there anyone around the 3-minute mark? Who said 3 minutes? 3 minutes, 2 seconds. Wow, that's exact. Yeah, you can keep on guessing.
How about...
Well, I would suggest that anyone who guesses less than 2 minutes and 30 seconds is not going to win a T-shirt.
Okay.
Hey, 2 minutes. 2 minutes.
Do you want me to read that for you? Hang on. Add that over to me. 2 minutes and 38 seconds. We had 2 minutes 30 here somewhere. Yes, this gentleman here. Round of applause. We're actually going to be running this demonstration again. Thank you. After we enable the block cache, and we'll have another opportunity for a T-shirt. Sorry.
Oop, sorry.
Need to bring it back again.
It's going.
Yep. So I'll just bring that back.
Okay. Okay. So while I'm going through the deck, Hanny's just going to enable the CSV cache. That's not presented through the UI currently. That's done via PowerShell, and we'll show you the command that does that. Question?
Lenovo W520, that's the storage server. Who asked the question?
Up the back there.
Oh, up the back. Yeah. I think there's about 8 gig of RAM in there. Look, pretty standard. The main thing here is it's a single spindle, and it's not an SSD single spindle. Right,
so from a performance perspective, for what the test that we were running, it was really about the I.O. I.O. is the thing that's going to bottleneck you there. The Hyper-V hosts, I think, are they're W500 Lenovos, so you know, dual core, 8 gig of RAM, nothing fancy. Okay, so let's have a look at some of the performance improvements while Hanny does some work there in the background. CSV optimization. So what have we done? Well, firstly, the algorithm in 2008 R2. For direct I/O versus metadata was pretty basic. Are you direct I/O? a metadata, redirect or non-redirect. The algorithm in 2012 was a lot more advanced, and the end result of it is that it actually goes redirect far less often. So it's doing it a lot less than it does in... I'm not talking in event of a failure here. I'm just talking in terms of normal running operation. Metadata updates go over the coordinator node, but it does that less often because the determination algorithm is more advanced. So you can see direct I/O there for all types of file opens, which previously in 2002 would have been a metadata redirect. So in terms of the block level I/O redirection, again, when we showed that demo, it was made the point that hey, that's the same as 2002. The end result is the same, yes, but the way that 2012 does it is actually a lot more efficient. As you can see there in the diagram, we're again simulating that failure of that, or we've seen that failure of that node storage. We're actually now avoids traversing the stack, the file system stack twice because of the changes to the filter driver that Hanny mentioned previously. The end result of that is the directed I/O when you are in full redirect mode is twice as efficient as it was before, which is why I said on the equipment that we have, I haven't tested it on 2008 R2, but I'm not sure if it would have worked. So now let's talk about some of the other improvements. Now these aren't specifically CSV improvements. They're improvements in Server 2012, things like RDMA and SMB3. Which are 2012 improvements, but these are 2012 improvements that CSV can then leverage. So we're talking that 98% there, saying improved performance of refactored SMB. So we're talking in certain circumstances in our testing, we were able to achieve 98% of native disk performance over fully redirected scenarios. And we were able to do that by a couple of ways. I mean, the first one is... SMB multi-channel in SMB3. Is anyone familiar with that? Has anyone seen it demonstrated? Know what it is? Yeah, a few. Okay. For those who haven't seen it, SMB3 the protocol is inherently able under the covers to detect multiple network paths to the same place. So if you've got SMB3 at both ends, so let's say you've got a Win8 client and a 2012 file server, if you're connecting to that file server, via a network path. If there's an additional network path to that same target, SMB will just transparently connect it and use it under the covers and then effectively give you W throughput if they're the same, both those links are the same bandwidth. They've demonstrated it at various tech eds. You can sort of, tech ed North America particularly, you can jump online and have a look at those sessions where you can see them doing an SMB copy and watch the throughput go. They're going over a single 1 gig line. They then plug in a 10 gig NIC. They just plug it into the switch and it goes, the data rate just bang, because it just picked it up and used it. Then they pull the 10 gig out, boom, goes back down to one. And so it just transparently connects in and uses those multiple channels. The other the other big advancement is the RDMA, which is the sort of new transmission protocol going over InfiniBand. And that's really just, again, another thing that's transparent under the covers, and if you've got the hardware in place, it just works. So if two NICs are making an SMB connection to each other, and they're both RDMA capable at the hardware level, then they simply they transparently talk to each other and say, hey, you're RDMA? I'm RDMA. Let's both talk RDMA. And it just transparently works under the covers. Now, the throughput of RDMA over InfiniBand is absolutely incredible. The last test results that I saw were 10.8, I think, megabytes. Not megabits, megabytes a second throughput. So that's about 2 DVDs per second throughput.
I just had a point there, Gary. The way that's actually working in RDMA is it's actually, if you like, it's offloading that transfer to the hardware, so to the network interfaces, and it's kind of doing it without involving the operating system. So we bypass kind of all the operating system components of the file system stack, and we go straight into memory. And that's why we get those really fast transfers.
So, yeah, as I was saying, 10.8 megabytes throughput. If you're in Jeff Woolsey's 2012 session on the first day, he was actually talking about 16. So they've obviously done some additional testing since the last figures that I saw. The one that I'm referencing, where they got 10.8 gigabytes a second throughput, that was actually being achieved with about less than 5, I think it was about 4.7% CPU overhead driving that kind of that throughput. And we're only able to achieve that because we're offloading to the RDMA hardware. So you can see when you combine the SMB multi-channel and also then potentially have the capability of the RDMA direct access. I mean, when you're talking about that kind of throughput, in most circumstances, you're not going to have a storage array which is going to be capable of driving that kind of network throughput. You're not going to be able to read and write to the disk fast enough to be able to achieve those numbers. So when we're talking about, when a storage failure occurs on a node and we go completely into directed I/O, if you have RDMA or even SMB multi-channel, it's not a big deal. It really isn't. In most cases, there's going to be more than enough network bandwidth there to handle whatever the read and writes of your storage is putting out. So that slide just covers off SMB multi-channel in a little bit more detail in terms of how it's just picking up those multiple network paths and just simply transparently using them. So when we combine all of those things, when we look at all of those performance improvements in CSVs in total, so we've got the I/O redirection happening far less often because of the improved algorithm. The block level redirection, the SMB multi-channel, RDMA, all of these things working together is really a substantial performance improvement for CSVs. And again, that worst case scenario of that complete redirected I/O is not a problem. So we're now going to flick back, and we're going to rerun our little test.
So what I've done while Gareth was talking, I've enabled the CSV block cache, and we're basically going to run that test again. We're going to fire up those 5 VMs. Shall we have a round of guessing again before we kick off? 1.5, 2 minutes, 1 minute.
48 seconds. How long?
Okay.
30.
We've got anywhere between 48 seconds and I think 1.5 minutes.
Yeah, I think someone said 30 over there.
30 seconds?
32.
Okay.
All right.
Before I do that, Gareth, I'll just show the guys.
Show the command, yeah.
This is the PowerShell command. I think Gareth already touched on this. But basically, this is setting the cache size, and that's consistent across the cluster. And we're actually enabling caching per volume. So you can see cluster disk 1 is where we're hosting all those virtual machines. I don't know if you can see all that. Yep. And 1 to enable and 0 to disable. So that's basically it.
Okay. You ready?
I've lost my VMs.
Yep.
Okay. On your count, mate.
Okay. 3, 2, 1. Same thing as last time, last machine to post is the one that we'll look at. There it goes, 6 again, lucky 6. So actually we were at probably 10 seconds before that last machine posted. Come on, connect.
So we started with 2 minutes and...
2 minutes and 38 seconds.
38 seconds, okay.
47 seconds. Are we good? We had someone claim, a T-shirt claim.
They're all very big, I'm afraid, but...
Not surprising when you think about it. I mean, the vast majority of that read I/O is obviously coming straight out of RAM on the Hyper-V host directly. So you'd expect it to be pretty quick. Just a little bit of detail with that cache as well. The cache is basically split into two halves. So the amount, if you, let's say, you give it a gig of memory for the cache, right, it's going to split it into two 512 blocks. And what it does is every read that comes in is stored in that first half of the cache, and that just populates up until it's full, and then the next read that comes in, it flushes the last one that came in. So that's just a transitory cache. The second half of the cache is a more permanent cache. So once we start to detect multiple reads, two and three reads on a block, then we move it over to the more permanent side of the 512 cache. And the things that are read more commonly are the things that then populate that second side. So we wanted that 50-50 split because you want stuff that gets accessed all the time to be more permanently held in cache, but you still do want a region of memory available for when... you know, for those transitory reads as they're coming through.
I guess you can see how this is particularly beneficial in a pooled, you know, VMVDI scenario when you're reading off a parent disk a lot of information. And, I mean, typically this is done at the storage layer, really. You have some sort of caching mechanism. We're just sort of bringing it up to the OS. We're trying to minimize the amount of times that you hit the platter, essentially. So just to finish up, we've just got a few slides on deployment considerations. So this is just the basic kind of requirements for CSV. I've sort of drummed on this a couple of times. It's got to be an NTS volume. We don't support REFS yet, but should be coming down the line. If you're using a node and disk majority quorum model, the witness disk can't be on a CSV volume. So that's something to keep in mind. And again, we support storage spaces. However, no, we don't support parity spaces, only simple and mirrored spaces, okay? And no Windows dedupe. Okay, so you know Server 2012 has dedupe functionality. Unfortunately, not for CSV yet. Yeah, I know, boo, yeah. This is a question that we get asked a lot. Gareth already touched on this, but you're basically saying, well, we can now have all nodes in the cluster accessing this volume. So, you know, we can consolidate virtual machines onto fewer LANs. So how many can we put on a single LAN, right? I mean, from a CSV perspective, you know, 64 nodes in a cluster go nuts. And by the way, how many VMs do we support? Anybody know? In a single cluster?
8,000.
Thank you, sir. 8,000? Oh, no.
Oh. Yeah.
That wasn't too bad. Basically, it comes down to a question of, can your storage array handle the IOPS? And really, it's a discussion with your storage vendors. Some, you know, vendors will say, go nuts, 64 nodes, 8,000 VMs hitting this poor, lonely LAN. We'll take care of it. We do, you know, some smarts underneath. We do storage tiering and caching and so forth, and we'll handle it. Others will say, well, to be honest, we want to know what kind of workloads are running and how many IOPS they need. And, you know, they'll pull out the calculator and say, oh, you need this many spindles, and we're going to raid in this fashion. So it really comes down to a conversation with your storage vendor. There's no limitation from a CSV perspective. So I touched on backup. We said that there's a lot of big wins in backup in 2012. So this is a big one. Distributed snapshots. We can now initiate a VSS snapshot on a node in a cluster, and it's responsible for orchestrating that snapshot across the entire cluster. So if you had a single LAN with 100 VMs spread out, you know, across your nodes in the cluster, it will be responsible for, you know, essentially talking to all the VSS writers and all the nodes and making sure we have an application consistent state across the entire cluster. So that's pretty cool. Parallel backups. We didn't do parallel backups in R2. We can now run, you know, backups on the same volume, different nodes, different volumes. So that's pretty straightforward. Non-disruptive backups. So we're not requiring a change in disk ownership when we're doing the backup. We don't need to move the LAN to where you called that backup request. We've improved I/O performance. So I mentioned earlier that we were in redirect mode for the entire backup duration previously. Now it's only that initial phase when we're taking a snapshot of the volume, but then when we pass the reference to the backup application to backup, you know, the shadow copy, After that, we're in direct mode. We're in direct mode for the rest of that backup operation. So it's only the first few seconds, really, when you take that snapshot, we're in redirect. And of course, we've improved interoperability. So you're not requiring, you know, you don't have to call a special set of CSV APIs, which no one seemed to know how to do anyway. So now, basically, we can just hook into the standard VSS infrastructure. In fact, you can use Windows Backup to back up a CSV volume. I'm not suggesting that that's your enterprise backup strategy, but it works. So just to summarize, what are the key takeaways? What have we changed in CSV and Server 2012? So we support more workloads, right? And going forward, we've actually published a paper around how to interoperate with, you know, the CSV API, so third-party vendors can develop applications for CSV and they'll be supported. Okay, so that's sort of the long run. We're kind of doing it, we're doing CSV block level IO and redirection and in a more performant, more efficient way. And really, Microsoft and the product team is getting quite serious about having a true clustered file system because we do realize it's a core component of your private cloud, so enabling your private cloud infrastructure. And they're very keen to hear feedback from the field, from our customers. So if you do, you know, want to see any new features, you know, dedupe, for example, you know, be active on the forums, you know, talk to us, let us know what's required, because they're very keen to make this an enterprise, best of breed, clustered file system, if you like. This is just some related content. I mean, most of these sessions have already passed, but all sessions are recorded and available, so you can go back and watch them. Gareth and I will actually be available in the speaker lounge if you'd like to talk more about CSVs, clustering, Hyper-V, whatever it is, Formula One. Gareth's a Formula One fan. So we'll be in the speaker lounge for an hour after this session.
I might be talking in sign language by the end of that.
And basically, that's all we have for you today. Please fill in the session evals. Tell us what we did badly. Tell us what we did well. We'd like to always improve this session and make sure you get the best value out of it. And I'll open up the floor for some questions. So, yep, over here.
If you've got existing 2008 R2 infrastructure, are there any problems with upgrading, given you've changed CSV so much?
So I'll just repeat the question for the recording. Basically, the question is, if you have an existing Server 2008 R2 cluster using CSV volumes, can you upgrade that? Well, the truth is, the reason why we didn't write a new file system, we didn't write a new clustered file system, we're just using NTFS with a layer of abstraction on top, is to enable interoperability and compatibility. So you can actually, you can dismount a CSV volume, and you can just mount it up on a standalone server if you want. So that was one of the key drivers for actually when revisiting CSV. Okay, good question. Thank you.
Just watch your pathing. If you were to say disable CSV from a LUN, dismount it, say mount it into a new 2012 cluster, re-enable CSVs, just make sure that your namespacing is still consistent, because that's going to be in your metadata files. Yeah.
Yep, sorry.
Just wondering if the CSV nodes need to be in the same subnet. CSV nodes, do they need to be in the same subnet?
Okay, so yeah, the question is, do the nodes in the cluster need to be in the same subnet? I believe we've just introduced multi-subnet support in Server 2012. He's a very happy man. Yes, sir? So this is a very good question. The question is around, in R2, we really recommended hardware-level snapshots, right? And I mentioned that's because of the way we were doing the redirection, and it didn't really provide us a safe way to actually integrate with our backup applications. So that's been resolved in Server 2012. Because you have a proxy file system stack, So you've got, you know, file system drivers, volume drivers. Your backup vendors now have a way to attach. Essentially, you can call that software snapshot from anywhere in the cluster.
So you don't need hardware?
No,
snapshot.
You don't.
No, it's reserved. So it's very similar to your it's very similar to your host reserve. If you were to set a host reserve on a Hyper-V box, it reserves that memory, and VMs can't consume it.
Okay.
When you set the CSV block cache, it reserves that memory, so then VMs can't consume it. It's a balancing act. I mean, if you're going 512 or a gig, I mean, most hosts are now 64 at a minimum or 192. Gigs, so carving out one gig for your cache is nothing. You should be able to sustain that on those hosts. You know, it shouldn't really lower your densities at all. Yep.
Is there a limitation on how many LANs can block cache enable? And there's no limitation, why wasn't it enabled by default?
I can't speak for why it wasn't enabled by default. There's no limit to the amount of LANs that you can enable the cache for. However, you've still got to be mindful of how big your memory pool is. So if you allocate a gig, it's not a gig per LUN, it's a gig total. So if you've got, you know, a huge number of LUNs coming in, then that may reduce the effectiveness of the cache in terms of you're going to have a lot more of those transitory reads that are just going in and out of the cache constantly.
Yeah, I can actually add to that, Gareth.
Yep.
The reason why it's not enabled by default is it really depends on the type of workload you're running as to whether you can really take advantage, because it's only an unbuffered read I/O cache. So you've got to think about what you're actually running in those workloads.
With 2008 R2, it was VMs only. We're now, because again, as Hanny mentioned, we wanted to get CSV out there, and it went from whiteboard to production in 12 months. So in order to meet that time frame, the product team said, right, this first release, which was in 2008 R2, was VMs only, was Hyper-V only. And when you enabled it in 2008 R2, there was a warning that came up and said, you are only to put VMs on this. We don't support anything else. With 2012, that's not the case. We support scale-out files, using CSVs for scale-out file servers, and the product team have visions to supporting other workloads in the future. So CSVs is now expanding beyond only the virtualization role, and in the future will support more workloads as well.
Yeah, so I guess really the thing to remember is, so if we think about the scale-out file server role, right, we talked about we support the scale-out file server role on CSVs, and in fact CSV is what enables the scale-out file server role to present that storage uniformly across all nodes in the cluster. Now, the scale-out, we still have a classic file server, right? The scale-out file server is designed as an application storage component. So you have things like SQL Server, for example. SQL Server, if you think about SQL Server, it's like Hyper-V. It's high read, write, I/O, low metadata updates, and that's the key, right? So things that are not good for CSV are things like Office, right? Very high metadata operations. In fact, I think there's been some testing with Office applications on CSV with the block cache. And I think performance was actually worse on CSV, right? So you got to think about the workload you're running and what they're actually designed for. So to answer your question, yes, all nodes in the cluster can access a volume simultaneously, and the metadata is orchestrated so we don't have corruption by multiple nodes in the cluster updating the metadata of a single volume. But again, it's really designed for high read applications like Hyper-V. Hyper-V, you just turn on a VM, you open a handle to that VM, and the rest is just I/O, right, to that VHD file. So I hope that answers the question.
Yeah.
So file server issues, sorry, if it can be used in a cluster file server or CSV?
Excuse me?
The CSV, you know, you just mentioned this one line. Can it be used in the cluster file server?
Absolutely. So in Server 2012, there's actually two flavors of the file server. So there's the classic file server. So that's where you store your user files and things like that for office productivity type applications. The scale out file server, and I encourage you to look at this, it's really quite interesting.
Scale out
file server role. Yeah, that's what it's actually called. And it's designed as an application store for server applications, essentially, like Hyper-V, SQL Server. I'm not sure what else is supported, but excuse me, I missed that question. iSCSI target? Yep, sorry. Yeah, so actually in that demonstration, the way, and I'm not sure if you touched this on this, Gareth, but basically the way we were, so we had three laptops, essentially two were cluster nodes, and we were using the inbuilt iSCSI initiator software to hit the third laptop, which was using the inbuilt iSCSI target software to present storage to those two nodes.
No, we just to clarify, there's a couple of ways that you can present the storage. There's the more sort of traditional cluster way of getting a LUN, and that can be fiber channel over Ethernet, iSCSI, you know, whatever it is. That's what we were doing there, presenting it via a LUN. Hyper-V also supports just running off a file share. So your VHDs can sit just on a file share. Now, you can't use CSV in that scenario because you're accessing it from the file share. You don't have a clustered LUN as such, so you don't enable CSVs in that scenario. So they're two slightly different use cases. But we weren't presenting via a file server in that instance. We were presenting a LUN. Yeah, no, it does. What I'm saying is there's two supported ways to provide storage to Hyper-V host where the VMs can run. You can do it via a LUN or you can do it via a file share. If you're doing it via a file share, you can still have clustering, and the way you set that up is you set up a standard cluster, you just don't add any storage. So if you go into that storage node in the cluster manager, it's empty. And then in your VM settings, instead of pointing to C, blah, 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 you just point to whack, whack, server name, whack, you know, whatever. And then it just accesses those VMs directly off the file share. But you can't enable CSV in that circumstance. So it depends on what you're after. I mean, the accessing off the file server is great in terms of, you know, it's very, very simple. You reduce your complexity. You don't have to worry about LUN management and storage and all that kind of stuff. And in fact, having a 2012 file server with a big bunch of JBOD presenting file shares that you use for your VM consumption is a great way to do it. But the alternative, the balance to that, is that you don't have access to CSVs. You can't enable that block cache. So if you were, say, you're doing a pool VDI scenario, you definitely go with a LUN presented so you can enable CSV and take advantage of the cache. So there's multiple ways to do it, and you just need to sort of look at your circumstances to see which way is better to go. Cheers.
Replicating them across continents using DFS, for example, just to distribute out those files.
Yeah? Yep.
Now I'm a SharePoint consultant. I have a lot of customers of mine that say, yeah, we want to use SharePoint for all of our documents. Let's get rid of the file servers and move them over to SharePoint. Yeah. Let's load everything into databases. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's have a look at remote blob storage and sort some problems out. Okay. But the biggest problem I've got is SharePoint is not a software that allows replication.
Yep.
So I can't use the same DFS kind of replication technologies in SharePoint. Yeah, I'm going to have a database here in Australia and somebody in Japan wants to access a document. Well, guess what? It's going to move all the way through whatever link I've got. Have you guys come across any cool solutions to this problem? Because I've got so many people that want to move away from guys, yes, great, collaboration, working documents, but is there any, I haven't figured it out. I really, that's one problem, I haven't figured out a decent solution.